Well, welcome back, everyone. Thank you for moving through so quickly. We have a straggler or two, but we are almost there. I am extremely pleased to welcome our next speaker, a man who took me aside in 1997, I believe it was, and taught me a lot about the Great Lakes and the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, made a special trip all the way from Detroit over to Chicago, and I don't know, spent 2 or 3 hours and gave me Great Lakes 101, 102, 103, whatever. And John Hartig, Dr. John Hartig, is, I think if I were to point to anyone, particularly on the U.S. side of this part of the Great Lakes system, has really distinguished himself as a man who really gets stuff done. Getting stuff done, you could be a mayor, John. But from Humbug Marsh to the managing the International Detroit River Wildlife Refuge, John has just done a phenomenal amount in this area. In fact, the flow of press releases about the new things that are happening with this International Wildlife Refuge are truly impressive. John is a person who can work with people of the stature of Congressman Dingell and work with a guy like me as well. So he's a man for all seasons, and I am just extremely pleased. He's going to talk about urban conservation, and you know we're about cities and water. But the thing that really appealed to me about John is I think what we need to do is bring nature more back into the urban setting so that the kids growing up know that it isn't all, you know, asphalt and concrete and pavement and stuff like that, that stuff grows, and John is a master of that as well. He's written widely, and you can get a discount on his new book as well, and we'll figure out how to make sure you have the information for that. But please join me in welcoming Dr. John Hartig.
Thank you so much. Well, it's a real pleasure to be here, and it's always great to see Dave. And we go back to working for Val Adamkus and some of the early work on the cleanup of degraded areas of the Great Lakes and remedial action plans and lake-wide management plans, and had a lot of fun. But I've spent the last while working exclusively on the Detroit River and Western Lake Erie, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit, give you a story about what we are. Make sure this works here. What comes to mind when you think of Detroit? I'm going to speed this up. It's usually automobiles. It's Motown. It's music. It's big industry. It's Rust Belt. All those things are true, but we're known for something else, and we're aspiring to be known for sustainable redevelopment and for close-to-home outdoor recreation, and that'll be sort of the end of the talk. But I'd like to explain Detroit metropolitan area in from a paradigm shift perspective, a significant change in thinking that results in a completely changed outlook. Think of what the printing press and personal computers have done in terms of changing the way we do business. Well, Detroit changed not only Michigan, the United States, North America, but the world. Think of during the fur trade, when they literally wiped out beaver on much of the European continent and came looking for beaver pelts, and our area was rich in it, and Detroit became like the epicenter of the fur trade, and literally hundreds of thousands of beaver pelts were exported annually. Think about settling the continent and how you would move goods and people, and how the first transportation corridors were the lakes themselves. And so Detroit became a leader in shipbuilding history. In fact, during the 1890s, more ships were built along the Detroit River than any city in the United States. And 1819, by act of Congress, they declared it a public highway. It was so busy with ship traffic. Everyone knows the story of automobiles and how Henry Ford helped put the world on wheels. But there was another paradigm shift. With the stroke of the pen, FDR changed all civilian productivity in metropolitan Detroit to military productivity with one single purpose, and that was to win the war. And of course, Detroit went on to become the arsenal of democracy. There were consequences of each of these paradigm shifts. The fur trade literally wiped out beaver east of the Mississippi River. The arsenal of democracy led to substantial oil pollution, especially in the Detroit River. 1946 to 1948, it was estimated 5.9 million gallons of oil and other petroleum products were discharged to the Detroit River each year. That's a lot of oil. It takes 1 gallon of oil to pollute 1 million gallons of water. So that means during that time period, there was enough oil going in to pollute the entire western basin of Lake Erie, all Michigan waters, all Ohio waters, all Ontario waters. It was a cold winter, just like, think back to this last February and how cold it was. The cold winter, there was little open water on the Detroit River. What was in the open water? All the oil. The ducks and geese started coming down from the north in their migration, looking for food in the wild celery beds of the Detroit River, and they landed in the few pockets of open water with the oil. Literally 11,000 ducks and geese died in a weekend on the Detroit River. A group of duck hunters collected those oil-soaked carcasses of ducks and geese, threw them in their pickup trucks, drove to Lansing, Michigan, the capital of Michigan, started throwing them on the sidewalk, threw them on the front steps, and the spirit of advocacy said, "How dare you do this to the place we call home?" They called a press conference. Today, these duck hunters are credited with starting the Industrial Pollution Control Program in Michigan. That's our history in Detroit. 1965, Time Magazine, Lake Erie was dead. We talked about algal blooms this morning. In the 60s, they were equal. And that was the front page, Lake Erie was dead. That was probably poor journalism. There was more phosphorus going in. The lakes were more alive than ever, but the algal blooms were settling out, using up oxygen, eliminating oxygen in the lower portion of the lake, killing fish. The algae and fish would windrow on bathing beaches, and they'd have to bring in front-end loaders and dump trucks to remove these decomposing algal blooms and dying fish, and it smelled like rotten eggs. But that was 1965. Here's some pictures of people starting to speak out, the public outcry over this. This is what they were protesting against. This was what they were seeing in their backyard. Adding insult to injury, in 1969, the Rouge River, just like the Cuyahoga, caught on fire. There was so much oil out there, a worker dropped an acetylene torch and flames shot 60 feet in the air. And it took 10 pieces of fire department equipment and the John Kendall in this lower picture to put out the fire on the Rouge River. The mercury crisis hit in 1970. Chemical plants in Wyandotte, Michigan and Sarnia, Ontario shut down the entire fishery for the St. Clair River, Lake St. Clair, Detroit River, and Western Lake Erie because of the mercury crisis. And then the first Earth Day. When most people think of the first Earth Day, they think of Madison, Wisconsin. They think of UC Berkeley and California. But you need to think about Detroit. And in the back of this photo on the left there, you see Cobo Hall. So back then, think of auto workers in Windsor and Detroit. And they would work 50 and 60 hours a week at a factory. And when they got done, what would they want to do? They wouldn't want to go in and be in a home. They'd want to be outdoors. So they went out and became hunters and fishermen. They loved the outdoors. So a group of auto workers, the boat on your left there is a Chris Craft with a U.S. flag on it. That was the UAW, the United Auto Workers from Detroit. And the one on the left, the right, is the Canadian Auto Workers. They went out on the Detroit River on the very first Earth Day and held a wake on the Detroit River, symbolizing the death of the Detroit River. It made national headlines equal to Madison and UC Berkeley and some of the other places. But all of these, you know, we had other winter duck kills in 1960 and 1967, anywhere between 10 and 16,000 ducks and geese. We had Silent Spring, written by Rachel Carson, in the 60s. We had the eutrophication of Lake Erie, the burning of the Rouge and Cuyahoga Rivers, and the mercury crisis. All of that led to Earth Day, the Canada Water Act of 1970, the Clean Water Act of 1972, the Canada-U.S. Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement that Dave mentioned of 1972, and the Endangered Species Act. What an accomplishment for legislation and for putting in place some fundamental building blocks for protecting our environment. It's been four decades. What's happened? We've seen substantial reductions in oil discharges and spills, and winter duck kills due to oil pollution have been eliminated on the Detroit River. We've spent literally billions of dollars, as all of you know in this room, on upgrading municipal wastewater treatment plants to secondary treatment with phosphorus removal. We've seen a 90% decline in phosphorus concentration and loading from the Detroit Wastewater Treatment Plant, this photo on the right, to the Detroit River and Western Lake Erie. Since 1960, there has been a 80% reduction in untreated combined sewer overflow volumes from communities in southeast Michigan. You heard a little bit about CSOs this morning. Between the 60s and 1980s, there was over a 4,000 metric ton per day decrease in chloride loadings due to process changes in chemical plants on the Detroit River. There was a 70% decline in mercury and a 90% decline in DDT in fish, yet health advisories still remain in effect for certain species in certain size classes. There was a 90% decline in DDE, a breakdown product of DDT, and an 85% decline in PCBs in herring gull eggs monitored on Fighting Island in the middle of the Detroit River, and we've remediated over 1 million cubic meters of contaminated sediment at a cost of $154 million. These environmental accomplishments are quite remarkable and are wonderful, but that is not the best part of the story. The best part of the story is the ecological recovery. We went 25 years with bald eagles trying to nest in the area and could not reproduce. Young could not hatch because of eggshell thinning, and now we have 22 active nests in the watershed of the Detroit River. Peregrine falcons, similarly, they had reproductive failure. They were reintroduced into hacking boxes in downtown Detroit on skyscrapers in 1987, and now we fledge 10 young per year in downtown Detroit. And they've actually expanded their range to the Ambassador Bridge. And in 2010, they fledged 3 young there. It's a tourist attraction on the Canadian side of the river. It's pretty neat to see them. We have osprey now who have nested in a cell phone tower and feed on fish in one of our units at the mouth of the Detroit River. And they fledged 2 young in 2009. And that was the first time osprey reproduced in Wayne County since the 1890s. Sturgeon are back in probably one of the most unbelievable areas. They've been spawning off of Zug Island, which is the Henry Ford's home for consolidating all operations for building a car from the bottom up. But for 30 years, there was no natural reproduction, and then they started spawning in the river. Similarly, Lake Whitefish are back. It used to be Detroit River was well known for its Lake Whitefish, but we destroyed its habitat, we polluted the river, we destroyed nursery grounds, and so in 2006 we documented their return, reproducing in the river for the first time since 1916. Back in the 70s, the walleye population was in a crisis state, according to the Lake Erie Committee, the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, and today, of course, we're part of the walleye capital of the world, and that's a 14.2-pound walleye. Because of Lake Erie, we grow them pretty big, and we have wonderful tournaments on the river. We had a few beaver that visited from up on Lake St. Clair on the Canadian side. They came swimming across the Detroit River and hit Belle Isle and didn't know what to do and kept coming in, and they found a power plant, a Conner Creek power plant there, and built a lodge and had four pups there. For 40 years, during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, they could not have survived in the river because of how much oil was in there. The oil would mat their fur, and they couldn't thermal regulate. But anyways, we've now got them in six locations, and the watershed is probably not ecologically significant, but it's of interest to lots of people. So if you add that up, the return of bald eagles, peregrine falcons, osprey, lake sturgeon, lake whitefish, walleye, wild celery, even beaver, it's one of the single most remarkable ecological recovery stories in North America. And think about where Detroit River started as one of the most polluted rivers in North America. But we have lots to do, as all of you know, and you fight on these issues every day. We still have population growth, transportation expansion, and land use changes that we have to deal with. Despite our best efforts, we still have incremental habitat loss and degradation. Obviously, non-point source pollution is a huge issue. We still have the legacy of the Industrial Revolution and toxic substances contamination in terms of contaminated sediment and brownfield sites. We have been ground zero for many exotic species, and of course we have greenhouse gases and global warming. Out of that recovery, Herb Gray, who was Deputy Prime Minister of Canada at the time, and John Dingell, who was the Dean of Congress, and one of his duck hunting buddies, Peter Stroh, who was CEO of Stroh Companies, Inc., Stroh's Beer, Stroh's Ice Cream, came together and said, we need to do something for, you know, the Windsor, Essex County area, and the Detroit metropolitan area. And so they said, why don't you pull together 25 people from the United States and 25 from Canada, and think together, if you could get some people like us to do something for you, what would you want? Would you want $1 million? Would you want a piece of land? What would you like? So we went away and had a workshop, and we came up with a conservation vision for the Lower Detroit River ecosystem. That vision called for an international wildlife refuge, the only one in North America. John Dingell picked it up in less than 1 year, got it through the House, the Senate, and had the President sign it in December of 2001 as the first international wildlife refuge in North America and one of the only few urban ones. And it would be founded on partnerships, what you people are so good at, for conservation and future generations. It was a new paradigm for conservation and sustainability. Our refuge, we have a refuge acquisition boundary that stretches from southwest Detroit all the way to the Ohio border in Canada. It starts at the head of the river at Pesh Isle, goes all the way down to the mouth of the Detroit River, and stretches as far east as Point Pelee National Park and Pelee Island. Right now, we have about 13,700 acres on the U.S. Registry of Lands for the International Wildlife Refuge, and we have about 4,800 acres on a Canadian Registry of Lands. Together, about 18,500 acres we are cooperatively managing for the refuge in an area with nearly 7 million people in a 45-minute drive. And our goal is to achieve 25,000 in the next 10 years. So what are some of the things we're doing? Hard engineering is concrete break wall and steel sheet piling. Soft shoreline engineering is making it just as safe, just as stable. Enhanced habitat, making it more aesthetically pleasing, and maybe even save you some money. So we've been doing that. Here's a good example of hard engineering in the upper left-hand corner. This is the DTE power plant in River Rouge, Michigan. Solid concrete and asphalt shoreline, took all that out, re-engineered it, and made it to look like that. Here's an old breakwater at Elizabeth Park, the oldest county park in the state of Michigan. It was put in 1910. They came to us and said, we're going to replace it. I said, before you replace it, could you please talk to us? And we were able to change their thinking and actually build into the river two oxbows, using some soft shoreline engineering techniques. In total, we've done 53 projects in the last 14 years in Windsor and Essex County and metropolitan Detroit, and many of them in prominent areas. Think about it as recreating a new waterfront porch for both people and wildlife. One of the other projects we've been working on is this, we took on, Dave mentioned Humbug Marsh, which is the last mile of natural shoreline on the U.S. mainland of the Detroit River. It's a Ramsar wetland of international importance. There's over 2,000 throughout the world. There's about 35 in the United States. There's only one in Michigan, and it's Humbug Marsh. Well, adjacent to it was this old Chrysler manufacturing facility. It was cleaned up. They made automotive brakes, which is code for asbestos, and solvents, paints. So you had solvents and heavy metals, organics and heavy metals. They cleaned it up to industrial standards and walked away. It sat as an industrial brownfield for 14 years. A developer came in and said, we would like to develop Humbug Marsh into a suburban community, a bridge to the island, a marina, a golf course, a riding stables, a strip mall, like we needed another one. And a group of citizens came out and fought the process through permitting because of wetlands. Working with Michigan DEQ, working with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and they were able to save it. As part of that process, the closest point to the island, which was where all the profit margin was for the big homes, was this former Chrysler site. So we were able to get some NOAA money, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration money, to purchase it for Wayne County to become the future home of our visitor center and to actually expand the ecological buffer for Humbug Marsh. And that's exactly what we did, and here's what it, a rendering of what it looks like right now. It's the first project in the world where we've successfully cleaned up an industrial brownfield sufficiently to serve as an ecological buffer for a Ramsar wetland of international importance. We will have a gold LEED certified visitor center there. It's under construction right now. It's about 12,000 square foot. It'll have a dock for the Great Lakes School Ship to take kids out onto the river and lake and use it as a living laboratory. It's connected to nearly 100 miles right now of Greenway Trail. It has a landing for the Heritage River Water Trail for canoeing and kayaking. It's a pretty special place. Another example of what we did is we were able to, once we found out that lake sturgeon were spawning off Zug Island in the river, we said, where would be a logical place where we could build some sturgeon habitat, some spawning habitat? The theory was that the sturgeon, productivity of the sturgeon was more limited now by habitat than environmental quality. And so we talked to everyone, and off Fighting Island became a target site based on lots of information from both Native Americans and the fishery community. And we were able to send $250,000 to Canada to help build a reef. So it was the first ever fish habitat restoration project in the Great Lakes funded with both U.S. and Canadian dollars. And then the very next spring, spawning season, the sturgeon came and it worked. And it was pretty amazing. We have now doubled the size of the reef in subsequent years there. And 16 partner organizations were involved, including many industries on both sides of the border, governments from both sides, NGO from both sides of the border. For those of you who don't know Detroit, but as recently as 6 years ago, this is what it would look like. If you have not been to, I would say if you've not been to Detroit in the last 6 months, you don't know it. It is changing that rapidly. And there's no better example of that than the waterfront. So think about, we made our the Detroit River our back door, like many communities, right? We brought in material storage. We had warehouses. We had industries. And some of those left. And that's what it looked like. Well, here's what it looks like today. And it's getting better all the time. This is called the Detroit River Walk. It's a 5.5-mile stretch from, if you know, the MacArthur Bridge to Belle Isle, which is the Belle Isle Bridge, all the way down past where the Red Wings play, Joe Louis to the Ambassador Bridge to Canada is a stretch. And it's one of the largest urban waterfront redevelopment project in the United States by scale. How many communities can take 5.5 miles of waterfront, wipe the slate clean, and start all over and do it. Amazing. In the worst economy, the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy, who is the champion and the convener of this work, raised $140 million in the worst economy in Detroit to make this happen. It's pretty neat. What we're trying to do now is through the process, it was important to be at the table during the design of this Detroit Riverwalk so that we could incorporate soft shoreline engineering techniques. And we've done that at five sites on the Detroit Riverwalk, including the top photo, which is we collect water off of a road called Atwater and a whole bunch of parking lots, and it goes through an innovative stormwater retention basin, and it cleans the water naturally, and then it goes into the Detroit River. We hold Kids Free Fishing Fest in downtown Detroit each year. We did a annual Sturgeon Day where high school students come in and go to four learning stations. They learn the natural history of Lake Sturgeon. They look like, what would a reef look like underwater, and build one with rocks on the shoreline. They would look on techniques of doing stock assessment, and then they culminate with, we bring up a 6-foot sturgeon, and they get to hold a 6-foot lake sturgeon. Pretty neat. We are creating a unique birding spot on the Detroit Riverwalk for by season. You would see in the fall, you would see raptors. In the winter, you would see waterfowl. In the spring, warblers. To give an entry experience to urban people and to get them interested in the river, to get them an interest in conservation and potentially develop a conservation ethic. We're also working on citizen science component for common terns, a threatened species in Ontario and Michigan. And we have fledged two on the island, and high school students are doing the monitoring of that program. It's pretty neat. We are the walleye capital of the world. We have $500,000 fishing tournaments on the river each year for the professional walleye trail. Ducks Unlimited identified our region as one of the top 10 metropolitan areas for waterfowl hunting. We've created, we are the intersection of two flyways, the Atlantic and Mississippi. There's unbelievable opportunities for birding, and so we've done a byways to flyways bird driving tour, which has 27 locations in southwest Ontario and southeast Michigan, places like Point Pelee, places like Lake Erie Metro Park and Holiday Beach, some phenomenal areas, and it's been really well received. We've got a Heritage River Water Trail for the next generation, and we've got 30 landings already in place on that. I'm a conservationist. Where do most conservationists want to work? Most of them would answer the question, I want to go to wilderness. I want to go to the Tetons. I want to go to the Canadian Rockies. I want to go to, they want to work in wilderness and pristine areas. They do not want to work in urban areas. But we need to challenge people like me and others to get out of the comfort zone and to think about it differently. Globally, where do most people live? On our planet, where do most people live? Cities. What percentage of the people in the world live in cities right now? 54 right now. So that's close. 54. In the United States and Canada, what percentage of people live in urban areas? It's the same percentage. Take a guess. It doesn't matter. So, this is 80%. Where's the next generation of conservationists and sustainability entrepreneurs going to come from? It's going to come from urban areas. What are we doing about it? We are really trying to rethink this and placing a high priority on cities, on urban areas. I think it comes together in this quote. This is a quote by William McDonough, a renowned architect and industrial designer. There are millions of difficult challenges and delightful opportunities ahead. I think the only constraint is the willingness to dream, to create, and to hope and feel undefended enough to face the tough questions and ideas that must be fiercely engaged at this moment in human history. If design is the signal of human intention, let me say that again. If design is the signal of human intention, then we must continuously ask ourselves, what are our intentions for our children, for the children of all species, for all time? And how do we profitably and boldly manifest the best of these intentions? Thank you for all you do for the Great Lakes and for working on sustainable development in your communities. And for all of us in the Great Lakes, we really appreciate all your support. Thank you so much. So is he pretty great or not? Good stuff, huh? We've got a couple of minutes for questions. We're gonna we got 7 minutes, and then we got a little break. Everybody's earned a break, so let's. We got the mic going. Warden McDougall. Where did the money come from for the Detroit Riverwalk? $140 million and counting. So think of Detroit is older than the United States. It was founded in 1701, so we're about 314 years old. And so think of there's lots of old corporations. There's lots of old money there. There are foundations like Kresge Foundation, Charles Stewart Mott, McGregor, Hudson Weber. There's some really old money. So to start out, you know, we had a blue ribbon committee that visioned for the river, and this, you know, that the time for Detroit was now to reclaim this land. And so and as part of that vision, they included Kresge and some of these in it, and said, you know, there's few people that can do what you do. And so Kresge was very good to us and put the first $50 million on the table. Corporations, General Motors was very generous because their world headquarters is on the river. So it's chasing money, and there's government money in there, there's foundation money, there's corporate money, there's lots of personal money. You know, people, individuals making a difference, and everything from the bricks to getting your name on the Cullen fountain, you know what I mean? Different things, but it's really the board is about 50 strong. It's lots of movers and shakers from Detroit, all committed to making a difference. And it's a pretty amazing story, and getting better as we speak. They've created a connector, the DeQuinder Cut, which is an old rail line, a below grade rail line that goes up to Eastern Market, the oldest market in the United States, and now goes up to Midtown. And so connecting the neighborhoods back to the river and this phenomenal resource. So, yes?
Another question. Dr. Hill.
I'm from Chicago, and I'm overwhelmed at what you presented. In Chicago, the press we hear about
is negative.
Yes. How is this impacting? You said thank you.
I don't. We get it all the time.
How is this remarkable development that you did that truly I would have thought would be with respect to another city?
Yeah.
Influencing the economic vitality of Detroit in of itself, where we heard in Chicago that you could buy a building for $1.
Yes. Yeah. No. Yes. So we obviously have a public image and a public perception problem, you know. And, you know, we're the largest city in the United States to go through bankruptcy, and Dave and I have talked about this. You know, we have all these tags, and most of them true, you know. But the media doesn't like to cover this story, you know what I mean? They like the negative stuff, you know, and everything like that. But if you look at, you know, Dan Gilbert, who owns the Cleveland Cavaliers, who just lost to the Warriors, he brought his entire organization, Quicken Loans and Rock Financial, into the heart of Detroit. He's making a huge difference. You know, a CompuWare coming into Detroit again. You know, these are companies that left and now are coming back. You know, and And what do you do for a younger generation? You can't just offer them a job anymore. You've got to have the whole thing. What are you going to do to live, work, and play and recreate and everything else? The other thing that helped us in Detroit is the whole thing going back to the corporations. When Ford Motor Company travels abroad, they're not from Dearborn, Michigan. They're from Detroit. When Chrysler is not from Auburn Hills, they're from Detroit. GM is in Detroit. So whatever the perception of Detroit is, that's what they're saddled with. So, you know, obviously in 1999, we had a chance to bring in the President's Council on Sustainable Development. In general, businesses and corporations have been ahead of governments and NGO on sustainability thinking, and so they got it right away. So they said, oh my goodness, how do we attract new employees? You know, most of the, we have 9 universities in a 45-minute drive, and most of those students, no offense, leave, and they go somewhere else and have wonderful lives. You know, but how do we keep some of them here? So we have to do more. So things like the Detroit Riverwalk, things like greenways, things like an international wildlife refuge, an international heritage river system, and stuff like that are really important in that and helping change the perception. And so we actually did a marketing piece with all the big corporations called Discover Our Wild Side to talk about us in a little different way. And there was a joint venture between Mazda and Ford to attract 10,000 employees to build the new Mustangs and everything else. And each one of the people applying for those jobs got a copy of this. And so we have a long ways to go. We have many social, economic, and environmental problems, but there's a good news story, and hopefully you got to see a little bit of it today.
Well, this is a story. This is a story you would not have gotten anyplace else. You heard it here first. And, you know, one of the beautiful things about Detroit, where are you going? Oh, you're going right there, here. You know, things have real names here, too. Zug Island, Humbug Marsh, Fighting Island, things like that. It's not these prissy names about stuff. You know, these are names that you can, you know, grab onto, and they give you some meaning. John, I'll tell you, he's a real hero. He really is a hero. He's my hero, what he has done over here. So let's give him a big round of applause.